Supporting WHYY, the Rutgers School of Business at Camden encourages working professionals in the region to take the next step in their career by earning a master's degree. The Rutgers Professional MBA and the Professional Master's in Accounting degrees are accelerated programs designed for working professionals with classes held on Saturdays in Mount Laurel. An information session is at 6:30 p.m. on Tuesday, July 7th at the Cherry Hill Library. Details at pmba.rutgers.edu or 856-225-2700.
As Amtrak struggles to meet an end-of-year deadline to equip its trains with a new automatic braking system, SEPTA says it's well on its way toward the same goal. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Today, SEPTA showed members of Congress and the media its new automatic braking system, Positive Train Control, or PTC, which is being installed on all its regional rail trains. The system would most likely have prevented the fatal Amtrak crash at Frankfort Junction in May. WHYY's Tom McDonald went along for a ride.
At SEPTA's test track in Fraser, Chester County, with four members of Congress in the conductor's cab, SEPTA crew showed how PTC works, how it hits the air brakes when a train goes over the speed limit.
Now the engineer continues to go over that allowable speed. You hear the alerts. You're not going to be able to do it much longer. And there it is. It got shut down.
Think of PTC as an invisible foot stepping on the brake of your car when you're going too fast. SEPTA's Dennis McAnola says it can override an engineer when necessary.
You're usually going to get about 77 to 100 pounds of brake pressure. You'll do an anti-lockup where it'll just sputter through until it actually comes to a complete stop, just like the anti-lock brakes in a car.
The equipment isn't cheap. $328 million to install on every train in the regional rail fleet. Congressman Shaka Fatah is impressed that PTC also can help improve safety for staff working on SEPTA tracks. Special armbands will buzz, alerting them when a train is coming their way.
If you think about being at a restaurant and they give you those little things in your hand, and it kind of makes a sensation when it's an opportunity for you to get seated, it's the same kind of information that will be transmitted to workers along the railroad bed.
SEPTA is one of the few railroads in the country that says it's on track to install PTC by the end of the year. Amtrak's also pledging to get their safety system running on the Northeast Corridor by the deadline. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
The Philadelphia City Controller's Office releases a report on what it calls dangerous and unsanitary conditions in the city's public schools. Details from WHYY's Laura Benshoff.
Kindergarten teacher Dan DiMartino works at Juniata Park Elementary in North Philadelphia. It's one of 20 schools the controller's office inspected over winter and spring.
I go to move a crate and I find all my books chewed up and mouse feces all over the books. So obviously, and mouse urine all over the books. So obviously I can't use those books anymore. I had to trash them.
DiMartino says he thinks short staffing is to blame for his school's pest problems. This isn't the first time City Controller Alan Butkovitz has brought inspectors into Philly public schools. 7 years ago, his office released a similar report, and he says conditions haven't improved.
In fact, conditions are more degraded and deteriorated.
Inspectors also found frayed high-voltage electrical wiring, fire hazards, and even asbestos in the sample of schools they visited. Spokesman Fernando Gallard says the district is doing its best, but doesn't have the funds to keep up buildings.
Our maintenance budget has declined. There's no surprises here. Things are not being cleaned as often, not as maintained as often.
After layoffs, he says the district still addressed more than 34,000 building complaints last year, and it's already taken care of that asbestos. For WHYY, I'm Laura Benshoff.
School's out for summer, but that's not stopping some 14,000 educators from gathering in Philadelphia at this year's annual International Society for Technology and Education Conference and Expo. On hand at the convention and here to take us to school is Education Week staff writer Ben Harreld. Ben, welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight.
Always good to be here, Dave.
Big crowd. Is it part education conference, part trade show?
That's exactly right. What you see is a ton of vendors from companies around the country who are trying to sell technology to schools, and there's a huge market for them. They sell about $8 billion worth of computers, tablets, software, curriculum each year, and then there's a ton of the teachers, administrators, and even students who actually use that stuff every day who come to talk about how they're using technology in the classroom.
And of course, it varies from district to district, the extent to which they're immersed in this new technology.
That's right. Some districts are now one-to-one with every student and every teacher with their own computer or laptop. And, you know, some districts are getting rid of print textbooks altogether and going all digital. Other districts like Philadelphia are taking more kind of tentative steps in that direction. But the really exciting thing is to see, you know, kids from around the country who are really doing some really, really compelling and interesting stuff with this technology when they get the chance to play.
For example?
I met a group of fifth graders from Kentucky who live in a very rural town, and they had actually developed a system on their own that allows any farmer with a smartphone to scan a tag on their cow's ears and get the complete health history for that cow. And it was something these kids had come up with as part of their technology club.
And fifth graders.
Met a 10-year-old girl who talked me through the whole thing, how she built a database and learned QR codes and stuff that I don't even really understand, frankly. But they had done it, and the farmers in the local community were very grateful for it. And, you know, now she's hooked on technology.
And in the course of this convention, it's a matter of jazzing up the attendees, saying perhaps you can do this too at your district.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about how to make sure all this technology is actually used for good and not just spending taxpayer dollars. And, you know, that's really, frankly, the challenge. What we see a lot is that districts will buy devices, buy curriculum, buy all of this stuff, but not necessarily have a good vision or plan for how it can be used. And it gets in the classroom, and it's either used for very basic things like, you know, practicing basic skills or kind of what they call drill and kill, or sometimes it just sits on a shelf and it never gets used at all.
Now, you cited some districts even have a one-to-one ratio. Is that the best in terms of the results? Are we seeing that those kids perform best?
I think part of the problem is there's still very limited research, peer-reviewed, academic, rigorous research that talks about how all of this technology actually impacts learning. So you hear a lot of anecdotes, both good and bad, but because it's all so new, I mean, if you remember, the iPad was only introduced in 2010, the research cycle is a little bit slower. And so, you know, even though we're spending all this money on it, we still really don't know exactly how it works.
You have me jazzed by that example in Kentucky. Does another one come to mind?
I actually met a group of high school students from around New York City who are part of a group called Mouse Corps. And so what they do is they get together, you know, from across the city every Tuesday, and they actually build their own technologies. And what they're working on now is building assistive technologies to help individuals with cerebral palsy be able to better access computers. So they had actually essentially gotten a video game joystick and modified it and then hacked the software so that they and turned it into a tool that someone with cerebral palsy who had limited access, you know, could only use her right hand, was able to use that as a tool to navigate around a computer and type with the joystick. And again, just very powerful stuff. And, you know, what I think you see is when kids are given both the opportunity and the resources and a project that allows them to try and make a difference in their own communities, they do some really, really amazing things.
You cited at the top that this is an $8 billion industry to date. Is it growing every year?
It's growing exponentially, and I think what you find is that as more and more districts want to go one-to-one with computers or laptops, and as more and more districts and states are mandated to administer standardized tests online, there's a lot of forces at work that are kind of forcing districts to go digital.
Ben, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Education Week staff writer Ben Harrell. Taking a look at this evening's headlines, in New Jersey, prosecutors in Monmouth and Ocean counties have formed a partnership with area hospitals to help stem the tide of drug overdoses. Under the agreement, the hospitals will allow law enforcement officers to exchange empty naloxone syringes for new doses free of charge. The overdose antidote is often sold in the U.S. under the brand name Narcan. Since April of last year, law enforcement in those counties responded to nearly 470 opiate-related overdoses with a 90% success rate. The National Weather Service confirms that it was a tornado with winds up to 95 miles an hour that hit Honeybrook, Pennsylvania during a severe thunderstorm last night. Forecasters today confirmed the twister after surveying damage it left while moving along a 1.5-mile-long path in the rural Chester County town. Amtrak joins a bid to have the lawsuits filed over a deadly crash in Philadelphia consolidated. 19 lawsuits have reportedly been filed in New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. The rail company says its liability is capped at $200 million. 84 degrees, partly cloudy skies on Independence Mall. It's 6:15. You're listening to NewsWorks Tonight on WHYY. This evening's forecast, partly cloudy, low overnight, 67 degrees. Tomorrow, intervals of sun and clouds. Thursday's high in the mid-80s. Friday, partly sunny, though there's a 30% chance of rain in the morning, high only 78 degrees. For the 4th of July, partly sunny, a 30% chance of showers. Saturday's high 82. And ahead to Sunday, plenty of sunshine, high in the mid-80s. Again, 84 degrees on Independence Mall. You're listening to WHYY. Still ahead, commemorating the anniversary of the gay rights movement, one advocate reveals why it was so important to march 50 years ago.
The movement wasn't taken seriously by most gay people. It was very hard to get them to picket. They just didn't see themselves as going out in the street and demonstrating.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Moore College of Art and Design offers career change part-time evening programs for adults at their convenient Center City campus. Students can create new options for their future by earning a professional certificate in interior design, print and web design, motion graphics, fashion design, or fashion merchandising. Registration for the Continuing Education Summer Session begins Monday, July 13th. Further details at moore.edu or 215-965-4030.
As your CEO, I had the pleasure of speaking to many of you when you called in during our recent membership drive. One of the many callers got me to thinking. She was born in China, brought up there, and then in Brazil, married an Italian citizen, and recently moved to Hockessin, Delaware. So while we each come from different walks of life, the one thing we do have in common is WHYY. It connects us to our communities and to one another. I'm Bill Morazzo and wish to thank you for making HYY so very strong.
I'm Dr. Russell Kaufman for the Wistar Institute, a proud supporter of WHYY. With the opening of our new seven-story Robert and Penny Fox Tower, Wistar Science is able to accelerate its efforts to create new cancer therapies. Our discoveries can help understand why cancers spread and are the basis for new Wistar drugs that target and attack the cause of advanced prostate cancer. Learn more about Wistar Science at wistar.org. Wistar Science saves lives.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Discoveries dominate big science headlines. Think cancer drugs that shrink tumors or new materials that revolutionize batteries. What happens, though, when an experiment fails? WHYY's Jessica McDonald looks at an unsung journal of negative results.
Not associated. No effect. Evidence against. These are not words that typically make it into the published scientific literature, but they are all over the titles of papers in the Journal of Negative Results in Biomedicine. When Harvard cell biologist Bjorn Olson told his colleagues about his idea to start the journal about 15 years ago, the response was not encouraging.
They were laughing, and I laughed with them.
But the more he thought about it, the more it was clear that such a journal was necessary. They might not be sexy, but negative results, findings that don't support a scientist's hypothesis, are hugely important. Olson says, in fact, negative results are the only ones that can provide definitive proof.
In the end, you can only prove that the hypothesis is wrong by getting the negative data that forced you to discard it.
Most famously, in 1887, a pair of scientists by the name of Michelson and Morley couldn't find any evidence for the prevailing idea that light waves traveled through a substance called ether. The result paved the way for Einstein to develop his theory of special relativity. In recognition, Michelson received the Nobel Prize in Physics. Kudos for failed experiments, however, are few and far between, and many don't even get written up.
Only about a half of all randomized controlled trials reach publication. So that means that people have enrolled in studies and have agreed to be tested using different interventions, and that knowledge never reaches the public domain.
Kay Dickerson is a professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. She's been studying publication bias since the 1980s. The biggest advance, she says, isn't a journal. It's a database that most clinical researchers seeking FDA approval must use.
The data that's in clinicaltrials.gov is better than what you would get in a publication. It's in a standardized format. And so you know what you're getting because it's required. There can be less missing data and so forth.
Compliance has been an issue, but it's a step toward getting all results, especially if a new drug didn't work, out in the open. That type of even-handed reporting, however, doesn't apply to basic biomedical research, the initial discoveries that get mined to develop new therapies. And for Glenn Begley, the chief scientific officer for the Malvern-based biotech company Tetralogic, that's a problem.
It distorts the reality so that we think something is more positive than it really is, simply because the negative results are not available for everyone to review.
Begley previously led the hematology oncology research program at Amgen, another pharma company. Frustrated by the high failure rate of cancer drugs, he decided to see how many landmark preclinical studies the group had been able to replicate over his decade of working there.
Of the 53, 47 were unable to be reproduced either by Amgen scientists or by the investigators themselves.
Begley says he expected some discrepancies. He was dealing with finicky biological systems, after all. This estimate, though, suggested that 90% of the literature was wrong.
Well, honestly, I was shocked with this finding.
He says it's a big part of why drug development is so slow.
The job is hard enough as it is without taking false leads and wasting time associated with that.
Diligent reporting of negative findings, of course, won't solve this whole problem, but it could cut down on the number of labs squandering resources only to discover the same dead end. It could make science faster and more efficient. How exactly to get there? Enter metascience, the science of studying science. Daniele Finelli is a senior research scientist at the Metric Center at Stanford. He's looked at how frequently negative results are reported in each scientific discipline.
When you move from the physical to the social sciences, you see the proportion of positive results reported as opposed to negative increasing, and increasing very dramatically.
The top offenders, psychology and psychiatry.
With around 95% of all studies declaring to have found a support for whatever they were testing.
Finelli says this suggests to him that there are different reasons, specific to each field, for why negative results don't generally see the light of day. For biologists and geneticists, it could be not taking the time to write up a paper for a failed project. For social scientists,
it is more that researchers have many degrees of freedom within their theories and methodologies to build the study that will produce the results they expect.
Both are problematic, but require different remedies. As for specialized journals for negative results, Finelli says it doesn't hurt. But obviously, if finding an outlet was the only problem, they should be swamped with submissions. Bjorn Olsen, the Journal of Negative Results in Biomedicine editor, says he gets hundreds to thousands a year, not much compared to the top-tier journals. But he says he's pleased with the progress.
I think that if this journal, by existing, can get people to think differently when it comes to what should be published in science, then I think it has been successful.
I'm Jessica McDonald, WHYY News.
This week, many in Philadelphia are celebrating two landmark events in the gay and lesbian community: the U.S. Supreme Court decision allowing same-sex marriages, and the 50th anniversary of the first gay rights demonstrations. For five consecutive 4th of July, starting in 1965, picketers rallied around Independence Hall to demand equality for homosexuals. They were organized in part by Barbara Giddings, a major gay rights activist who died in 2007. Her partner of 46 years was Kay LaHusen, one of the original picketers. LaHusen remembers what those demonstrations were like.
There was the usual 4th of July parade. Then all the tourists that had assembled to watch the big parade sort of went home, and not many people were left to see us. We didn't come on the scene until about 4 o'clock or something. And other people, you know, they'd been standing in the hot sun, and they had to go to the bathroom, they had to get something to eat. They were fed up with their 4th of July. So we got out there very bravely, but hardly anybody was watching. There are gay people who can't fathom really what these pickets were all about. But we were picketing for fair employment, the right to hold security clearances, the right to serve in the military, and work in civil service. Well, one of the signs said, "Honorable discharges for honorable service. We are not dishonorable." I like that sign. I was the chronicler. How the hell do we have all these photos if I hadn't taken them? Very few other people brought a camera or were shooting except the FBI. But the movement wasn't taken seriously by most gay people. It was very hard to get them to pick it. Not only were they afraid they might lose their job or their security clearance or whatever, but they just didn't see themselves as going out in the street and demonstrating. Somebody had to get out and show their face in public and proclaim things and be aggressive. We knew we were doing something important. We didn't know how important it might be, because you never know when you're in the midst of making history. You can't get a good fix on how important it may be ultimately. I always felt that we were right and they were wrong. I mean, that's what you have to believe when you go against the current mores.
That's Kayla Husen recalling the Independence Day protests for gay rights in Philadelphia in 1965. We've been marking the 50th anniversary of those first demonstrations throughout this week on Newsworks Tonight. Finally this evening, let's look at Pennsylvania potent potable predilections. Penn Live compiled data from the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board from June 2014 to this past May, looking at how much was spent on different types of alcohol across the state. Not so surprisingly, the most populous counties consumed the most alcohol. Philadelphia guzzled nearly $179 million worth of booze during the past year, second only to Allegheny County. Perhaps a bit more surprising is that the most popular alcohol in the state is vodka. Well, guess we've got a lot of martini lovers. Whiskey's the second most popular, followed by white table wine, although Fulton, Mifflin, Forest, and Susquehanna counties didn't sell any table wine during that time period. Bottoming out the list, rosé, cocktails, and dessert wine. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Tomorrow evening, we'll conclude our series of interviews with pioneers of the gay rights movement. We'll hear from Cuban LGBT activist Ada Bello. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.
Abington Hospital Jefferson Health supports WHYY. Abington Hospital has been recognized as a fully accredited chest pain center by the Society of Cardiovascular Patient Care. The specialized physicians at their Heart and Vascular Institute help patients who arrive with symptoms of a heart attack, quickly evaluating patients experiencing these symptoms and offering the best available treatment options. If you have chest pain, their team is dedicated to helping you continue to enjoy life. Learn more at jefferson.edu/abington.
Charleston's African-American community is united after the church shootings, but there's a range of responses.
Anger at this kind of mayhem is a normal and natural reaction.
Forgiveness is not the same as ignoring the facts. We want justice.
I'm Linda Wertheimer. Justice and mercy in Charleston tomorrow on Morning Edition.
Get more interesting weekday mornings on WHYY.